Welcome back to the Paseo Pathway podcast. We are in for a treat this week because on for the third time, I think that qualifies as a veteran now. You're no longer a guest, although I still want you to introduce yourself in case someone missed those other two episodes. Ashley Goslin is with us. Ashley, thanks for joining me. Yeah, just a few words. Tell folks who you are and a little bit about your family.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on here. I kind of really enjoy these conversations. Hi, I'm Ashley. I'm the kids director at Paseo. My husband Dylan and I, we've been a part of Paseo a couple of different times. We are military, so we moved away for a while and then we came back. It's been an honor to be a part of this community again, and I'm just really grateful to be here.
One thing Ashley did not mention, but it's very true. Since I've known her, she is a student of the scriptures, loves the scriptures, loves to read and to study. Yes. And so that works really well to come on this podcast and talk about John chapter 4. We're going to be talking about Jesus's conversation with the woman at the well. And before we dive into that, we always want to share a tip for better reading or getting more out of the scriptures when you read. And today's tip is to pay attention to location. This isn't always true. Sometimes you're reading a book like Romans where it's more theological, but if you're reading narrative, oftentimes scripture will tell you where something is happening. And that's the case in John chapter 4. It's actually a big part of the story of Jesus and this conversation with the woman at Samaria. So you did some research actually in prep for today's conversation about the mountain where she says our fathers worshiped in this mountain. And so I wanted to have you just share a little bit of that before we dive in.
Yeah, absolutely. I was able to really dive into the text and listen to it quite a few times. And I'm very familiar with this story as well. But one thing that intrigued me was that these people were inbred. They weren't actually completely Jewish. And so that actually was a lot of the contention that the Jews had with these people as they had married others that were not Jewish. And so you have this culture of people that have a background of this mountain that Jacob was on. And so they had actually built a temple there, and then a raid of Jews actually came and tore it down. So they're also aware of how much they hate them because they are not.
So the Samaritans had built the temple.
The Samaritans had built
and Jewish people had come in and forcibly destroyed
it. Yeah. Yes. And that built up a lot of tension. I mean, if someone came and destroyed my temple that I made for my God, even if I'm not wholly worshiping just one God, I mean, I would be really upset as well.
One suggestion I give for folks, especially as you're reading narrative, is to imagine that you're going to recreate this scene as a video. And so you're going to recreate Jesus with the woman at the well in Samaria. And just imagine yourself as a director. And so you've got your camera and you're thinking about recreating this. The first thing you're going to think about is location. Like, where are we shooting? So this is an outdoor shot. You're going to have the well. It's going to be in Samaria. There's going to be a mountain nearby because she references that. And then you think about casting. Who's going to be in the scene? Well, in this case, you have really Jesus and the woman, the disciples. Depending on how extensive you go in John 4, you might have the disciples there at the beginning, and then they leave to go get lunch, and it's just Jesus and the woman comes. And then you think about script. What's the dialogue? What's being said? And I think you can activate your sanctified imagination, and you can kind of begin to consider what's the tone. So as Jesus and this woman are interacting, I think that's actually a very important consideration. If you were directing actors to recreate it, what's the tone of this conversation? And we'll dive into all of that as we look at John chapter 4. But imagine that as you're reading the Gospels in particular, think about it as, it's a great way to study the Bible, is just to walk through what would it take to recreate this scene for a short video shot. And you'll actually probably discern a lot of details that you would miss if you were just reading through it as text on a page. But let's do that. Let's read through John chapter 4, verses 1 through 26. And I'll have you read that if that's okay.
Yeah,
and
sure.
And then we'll start exploring it together.
Okay. Jesus knew the Pharisees had heard that he was baptizing and making more disciples than John. Though Jesus himself didn't baptize them, his disciples did. So he left Judea and returned to Galilee. He had to go through Samaria on the way. Eventually, he came to the Samaritan village of Sychar near the field that Jacob gave to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there, and Jesus, tired from the long walk, sat wearily beside the well about noontime. Soon a Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, "Please give me a drink." He was alone at the time because his disciples had gone into the village to buy some food. The woman was surprised, for Jews refused to have anything to do with Samaritans. She said to Jesus, "You are a Jew, and I am a Samaritan woman. Why are you asking me for a drink?" Jesus replied, "If you only knew the gift God has for you and who you are speaking to, you would ask me, and I would give you living water." "But sir, you don't have a rope or a bucket," she said, "and this well is very deep. Where would you get this living water? And besides, do you think you're greater than our ancestor Jacob, who gave us this well? How can you offer better water than he and his sons and his animals enjoyed?" Jesus replied, "Anyone who drinks this water will soon become thirsty again, but those who drink the water I give will never be thirsty again. It becomes a fresh, bubbling spring within them, giving them eternal life." "Please, sir," the woman said, "give me this water. Then I'll never be thirsty again, and I won't have to come here to get water." "Go and get your husband," Jesus told her. "I don't have a husband," the woman replied. Jesus said, "You're right. You don't have a husband, for you have had 5 husbands, and you aren't even married to the man you're living with now. You certainly spoke the truth." "Sir," the woman said, "you must be a prophet. So tell me, why is it that you Jews insist that Jerusalem is the only place of worship, while we Samaritans claim it is here on Mount Gerizim where our ancestors worshipped?" Jesus replied, "Believe me, dear woman, the time is coming when it no longer will matter whether you worship the Father on this mountain or in Jerusalem. You Samaritans know very little about the one you worship, while we Jews know all about him, for our salvation comes through the Jews. But the time is coming, indeed, it's here now, when true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. The Father is looking for those who will worship him that way. For God is spirit, so those who worship him must worship him in spirit and truth." The woman said, "I know the Messiah is coming, the one who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." Then Jesus told her, "I am the Messiah." I'm going to keep going.
No, that's good.
Oh, sorry.
I love this passage. There's so much in here. I'm trying to stay quiet on the mic here as you're reading. There's so much good stuff in this interaction between Jesus and this woman. But before we dive into John 4, let me spin us back. One thing I love about reading in different places, like we're doing this year with the reading plan. So we've been reading in 2 Kings, we've been reading in Psalms, we've been reading in John. And so often you'll see how the Bible is woven together. And so we've actually read this past week in 2 Kings, a passage that's relevant to John chapter 4. And so let me read it for us here this morning before we get back to John 4. This is out of 2 Kings chapter 17, and it has to do with the exile of God's people, the northern kingdom of Israel, by the Assyrians. And I'm just going to read a few verses starting in verse 22. 2 Kings 17, 22. It says, "The Israelites," that is the northern kingdom, "persisted in all the sins that Jeroboam committed and did not turn away from them. Finally, Yahweh removed Israel from his presence, just as he had declared through all his servants, the prophets. So Israel has been exiled to Assyria from their homeland to this very day." To this very day being when the person writing 2 Kings was writing this. Verse 24, "Then the king of Assyria brought people from Babylon, Cuthah, Ava, Hamath, and Sepharvaim, and settled them in place of the Israelites in the cities of Samaria. The settlers took possession of Samaria and lived in its cities." So understand that the Jewish people, the northern 10 tribes, had been unfaithful to Yahweh. And so after centuries of warning them by the prophets to return to him, God brings the Assyrian Empire, which conquers these tribes, conquers the northern kingdom, and pulls the Jewish people out of this region and moves them beyond the Euphrates. Then they take people from those regions and plant them in this northern kingdom, which became, by the time Jesus comes on the scene, Samaria and Galilee. And so Galilee is sometimes referred to as Galilee of the Gentiles. And that's because there had been this intermixing of Jewish and non-Jewish people because of the Assyrian exile.
Yeah.
Now that's this is 730 years before Jesus and the Samaritan woman are having this conversation. But if we read a little further here in 2 Kings, it says that the people that had been brought, the non-Jewish people who had been moved into Samaria, it says in verse 32, they feared Yahweh, but they also made from their ranks priests for the high places who were working for them at the shrines of the high places. They feared Yahweh, but they also worshiped their own gods according to the practice of the nations from which they had been deported. And so this speaks to why the Jewish people were so antagonistic toward the Samaritans and vice versa, because the Jewish people saw the Samaritans in some ways as something worse than Gentiles, because a Gentile was just a complete non-believer. A Samaritan was someone who had adopted parts of the Jewish faith in Yahweh, but had mixed it and blended it with these other customs and religions. And so that's where we find the story in John chapter 4. So let's pick it back up, and we're going to experiment, or we're going to use our imagination to get into the tone here, because I think it brings a lot of humor, and I think it's likely the case that Jesus meets this woman in verse 7 of chapter 4. A woman of Samaria came to draw water. "Give me a drink," Jesus said to her, because his disciples had gone into the town to buy food. Her response, her first response, "How is it that you, a Jewish man, ask me for a drink, as I am a Samaritan woman? For Jews do not associate with Samaritans." Now, how do you think she said that?
How do I think she said
that?
Yeah,
like, what do you think her tone of voice was when
she
said this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's in shock. She's surprised. I mean, she's here at noon, which is not a common time for them to go to the well. Typically, they would go with other women. So mm-hmm. she's avoiding people. She's going there at the hottest point of the day. And now all of a sudden, this man dressed
Jewish
in full Jewish attire comes
up, speaking to
her. Talks to her. Well, first off, like, also prophets and leaders in the synagogues, they won't talk to a woman. Like, they don't. They will talk to the husband. And so it's ironic that, like, he's coming to her. He's talking to her. And it's funny that later in the passage, he says, "Hey, where's your husband?" Because of the culture of that time. But it's wild. She's probably like, "Why are you talking to me?"
I think she was a little cheeky, to be honest. And we'll see. If we go a little bit further, Jesus says, but he doesn't take the bait. He just says, "If you knew the gift of God and who is saying to you, 'Give me a drink,' you would ask him and he would give you living water." Then the woman responds, "Sir, you don't even have a bucket. And this well is deep.
Yeah.
So where are you going to get this living water?" And then here's another statement. "You aren't greater than our father Jacob, are you?" Now, if she had said that to probably any other Jewish man, maybe
right.
even the disciples, that's actually an insulting statement. Like, she's claiming Jacob as
right.
her father, as the Samaritan's father, whereas the Jewish people saw themselves as the true descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.
Correct.
And so she's asking Jesus, "Do you consider yourself greater than Jacob, our father, who gave us this well and drank from it himself?" Again, though, Jesus does not take the bait. He says in verse 13, "Everyone who drinks from this water will get thirsty again, but whoever drinks from the water that I give him will never get thirsty again. In fact, the water I give him will become a well of water springing up in him for eternal life." Now, this, I'm guessing, sounds nonsensical to her, because we're familiar with this passage, but she's having this conversation with this strange Jewish man in real time. And so she says, "Sir, give me this water so that I won't get thirsty and come here to draw water." And I think she said it in a scoffing way. "Man, give me this water. That way I'm never thirsty and I don't have to come all the way out here to drag water out of this well." So up until this point, it's not confrontational, but this conversation, she's several times brought up barriers. "You're a Jewish man, I'm a Samaritan woman." Right. Later, "You don't have a bucket, where are you gonna get the water?" "Our father Jacob," so again, the playing on this Samaritan. Here, I think maybe just a little bit tongue in cheek, "Yeah, give me this water. That way I don't have to get thirsty and come back here." And then things get real because Jesus says, "Go call your husband and come back here." She says, "I don't have a husband." "You've correctly said, I don't have a husband. For you've had five and the man you now have is not your husband. What you have said is true." And I love the next verse because she says, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." So now she's like, okay, this guy, yeah. I don't know what's going on here, but it's already been a strange conversation. He's saying some weird stuff, but he knows things about me that no one should be able to know. So let's explore this and say and see what are the barriers? What does it teach us about Jesus, the way he's interacting with this woman? What are some of the lessons that we can learn about his character and his desire to connect with people that are unlike him?
Absolutely. Well, first I really see that it's him not judging her and not putting her in a place where she's gonna feel offended, but it's in a place of, hey, I'm going to talk with you about this living water, which typically I think was referring to a stream, right? Because mm-hmm. it was moving. And so like in their culture, it's like, oh, well, that's not right here. This is what we have, is this well. Mm-hmm. And I think it's funny that she does say, oh, well, give me some of this. It's kind of like a quick fix of like, okay, well, give me some of this living water. I want that, you know, but there's no work there. But ironically, the next thing he brings up is the sin in her life in a way of like, exposing it without making her be like, whoa, dude, like, absolutely not, you know, but it's more of like getting to the heart and really being like, hey, like, this is something that's in your life. Like, and I think it's funny that she says, you must be a prophet, because this is a word of knowledge. This is something that he knows that he isn't a part of their culture. Like, he doesn't see them, like, he's not in their community, like, if someone had come up to me and started talking to me about personal things in my life, at first I'd be really caught off guard and I'd be like, whoa, okay. But I absolutely love this because he's calling her into relationship with him. And it, we read the Master Plan of Evangelism a while back in a group setting in Andrew's house. And it was crazy to see this awesome idea that came from that book of how Jesus would plant things in people's lives and then they would go out and do the work. And so it's kind of cool because he's really getting to the heart of what's going on in this woman's life. And the next thing you see her do is go out and speak to those people and bring them back to Jesus. But I love how he really just gets to the heart. He's calling her into relationship with him by this conversation that he's having with her.
Yeah, I agree. And how he's really doing all of the initiating and overcoming of the barriers that she's throwing up. I think at this point, she is truly and properly engaged in the conversation.
Yeah, you know? 100%.
However, she's still not ready to let go of these barriers because she says, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our ancestors worshipped in this mountain, but you Jews say that the place to worship is in Jerusalem." And so she still has this concern that you and I are not the same. So yeah, you're a prophet, but you're a Jewish prophet. Our ancestors worshipped in this mountain. And then Jesus, again, now we're getting into a true spiritual conversation. We've gone from talking about water and being thirsty to talking about worshiping the worship of God. And Jesus tells her, "Believe me, woman, an hour is coming when you will worship the Father, neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem. You Samaritans worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know, for salvation is from the Jews. But an hour is coming, and is now here, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father wants such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." And there's so much great stuff in here. It's stuff that we take for granted, where if we had lived, 2,500 years ago, BC, before Christ, and we wanted to worship the one true God, we would need to physically journey to a place, Jerusalem. Yeah. This was the place where God had designated for the true worship. But Jesus says the hour for that to change has come. Neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem shall you worship the Father. Now, if we want to worship the one true God, the true place that we have to go is Jesus. This is the one that we now gather around. We don't gather around this physical place, this physical temple, but we draw near to Jesus, and that's where we're going to find the Father. Now, last thing here. The woman said, "I know that the Messiah is coming, who is called Christ. When he comes, he will explain everything to us." And Jesus tells her,
"I am the Messiah," which "I am" in itself is wild.
Yeah, this is such an amazing passage. There are so many mic drop moments just in this conversation between Jesus and the Samaritan woman. But imagine that she's, and actually this last thing that she says, it's kind of the first time where I don't pick up a note of her thinking of herself as being different. She just says, "We know that the Messiah is coming, and when he comes, he'll explain everything to us." And maybe at that point, she was just getting at, Jesus was dropping some crazy stuff on her about worshiping God in spirit and truth and not in this mountain or that mountain. And so maybe she just was almost a way of saying, "I don't really understand what you're talking about, but when the Messiah comes, that's the one that we're going to listen to." And then Jesus hits her with,
"I am the Messiah.
The one that's been talking to you, I am the Messiah." And at this point, we're not going to continue on, but the disciples come back, the woman goes back into the city, and it's an amazing story of how Jesus draws this woman who's completely on the outside looking in, and brings her into worshiping the one true God in spirit and truth. So we could talk about this for a long time, but yeah. What are some of your takeaway thoughts or final thoughts before we transition to our listener question?
Well, I think my biggest takeaway thought is that Jesus cares for us. He loves us tenderly. He cares about our whole being. And what I love is that he's drawing this outcast in. And there are so many different cultural reasons why, she wouldn't be talking to him. She wouldn't be able to obviously have a conversation with him. He is clearing up her theology. He's clearing up her sin. He's clearing up, "Hey, I don't want you here by yourself." And it's absolutely mind-blowing to those that are around. The disciples are like, "What are you doing?"
Right.
You know, and but it just goes to show that Jesus cares for everyone. And, he is preaching to the ends of the earth. And he does care about me. He cares about you. And we're not Jewish. And so I think the biggest takeaway from this is that Jesus is calling all of us into relationship with him, and he loves us no matter what our background is, no matter what our culture is, and that, he really cares, and he's going to take the time to work in us to help us to gain clarification on who he's called us to be and how he's called us to be that. That's the biggest takeaway from this for me.
Yeah, I love that too. And we can lose sight of this, that John 4 really provides us with, in one scene, a graphic picture of what Jesus did just by coming to earth. So Jesus, if we imagine him in eternity past, he is in this completely holy state of fellowship with the Father. And Jesus chooses to take on flesh and blood and to come down as a man and walk the fallen earth among sinful people. Yeah. So he is not hesitant to enter in to conversation with those of us who are fallen. And so I think a takeaway from me is, will I go out of my way to reach out to people who are other than me, or will I allow those sense, that sense of being different, that we're not the same, you and I are not the same, can I be a missionary and go beyond those barriers to connect with people who don't yet know Jesus, and go out of my way to not only initiate, but to overcome those differences and invite them into a worship of the one true God in spirit and in truth. That's what we see here with Jesus. Just a masterclass in connecting with people who are different than us, not being offended by some statements that were honestly kind of offensive. Like, they could have very well been taken offense at what she was saying to him, but totally avoiding that and continuing to press forward with the truth, starting with the physical reality of water and thirst, and then moving it to this spiritual truth, or the physical reality of a mountain where we worship God, to this spiritual principle of we worship God in spirit and truth. Really cool stuff. Well, let's shift gears. Although, once again, there'll be a connection here for us. Our listener question this week is based out of the book of Kings. We've been reading 1 and 2 Kings. And actually, if you wouldn't mind reading this for us, Ashley, we'll be reading from 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 1 through 4. Okay. If you'd be willing to read those verses. But the question is, reading in Kings, it often speaks of high places. What were these high places and why were they important? So it does talk about it all throughout the book of Kings, but we'll read this one passage about Hezekiah, king of Judah, from 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 1 through 4.
That's a great question. So 2 Kings 18, 1 through 4. In the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, Hezekiah, son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned in Jerusalem 29 years. His mother name was Abijah, daughter of Zechariah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, just as his father David had done. He removed the high places, smashed the sacred stones, and cut down Asherah poles. He broke into pieces the bronze snake Moses had made, for up to that time the Israelites had been burning incense to it. It was called Nehushtan, I think.
Yeah, so, which is also a callback to last week's episode. Daniel and I talked about John 3 and this bronze serpent. Lo and behold, by the time we get to Hezekiah, king of Judah, this thing that God had given to the Israelites as a way of healing them from being bitten by these poisonous snakes, they've started worshiping it. So Hezekiah actually destroys this bronze serpent. But he talks about the high places here, and that Hezekiah was one of the few kings who removed the high places and insisted that the people worship in the one true location of Jerusalem, which ties to John 4, because Jesus says, now that's no longer the case. So you kind of see the progression of worship here in the scriptures that, in fact, let me just read Deuteronomy 12, verses 1 through 8, and we'll see about these high places from all the way back during the time of Moses. So in Deuteronomy 12, starting in verse 1, Moses says, be careful to follow these statutes and ordinances in the land that Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, has given you to possess all the days you live on the earth. Destroy completely all the places where the nations that you are driving out worship their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every green tree. Tear down their altars, smash their sacred pillars, burn their Asherah poles, cut down the carved images of their gods, and wipe out their names from every place. Don't worship Yahweh your God this way. Instead, turn to the place Yahweh your God chooses from all your tribes to put his name for his dwelling, and go there. You are to bring there your burnt offerings and sacrifices, your tenths and personal contributions, your vow offerings and free will offerings, and the firstborn of your herds and flocks. You will eat there in the presence of Yahweh your God, and rejoice with your household in everything you do, because Yahweh your God has blessed you. You are not to do as we are doing here today. Everyone is doing whatever seems right in his own sight. And I think if we could just kind of like encapsulate, what were the high places? The high places were where you would go to worship God in whatever way seemed right to you.
Yep.
And so what God was doing initially, he was restraining that worship so that now once he chooses Jerusalem and once he puts his temple there, which is what Moses had predicted God would do, now everyone is to come to Jerusalem and worship God there. And so the high places were demonstrative of a people who were worshiping God the way they wanted to worship him.
Absolutely.
Which is not acceptable to God.
Yeah.
God wants his people to worship him in spirit and in truth. And it comes full circle to John 4, because now Jesus says, we're not doing it this way either. We're no longer having to travel to Jerusalem.
Right.
To worship the one true God, because God has come among us and God gives us his spirit. And now we are always in the presence of God. And what matters is that we worship him in spirit and in truth. So any final thoughts on high places from you?
Well, I mean, even thinking about it just in these different verses, it's kind of wild to think of how far they've come, because, you know, when they didn't initially have the breakup, a lot of those high places were actually put up and they were like golden calves. And they did that because he was afraid that they were going to turn and not be faithful to him, which is ironic.
King
and so he set up these different people to be the priests that weren't really able to be priests. And, you know, and then you have like all these different pagan gods coming in. And it's ironic that also like this Kings passage, I think the three kings before that, they didn't tear down those high places.
And some of them were commended as
good
kings.
But they did do what they needed to. They walked faithfully, but they didn't tear down the high places.
Right.
So it's cool that, you know, you have this passage with Ahaz and he does tear down those high places. And so it's kind of cool to like see these different passages as well. And then you like even see Daniel, like in the book of Daniel, like he will worship toward Jerusalem when he's praying every day, you know, things like that. It's like there's a lot behind this worship in Jerusalem that's taking place. Like even when they were exiled, you know, they're still facing that direction when they're praying to God. And so it's kind of cool to think about like, wow, like there's a lot behind this. There's really a lot.
The city of Jerusalem, this might be a good way to just kind of wrap things up. The city of Jerusalem was the place on earth where sacrifices were acceptable to God to cover sin.
Yeah.
And the reason why we no longer have to go there to offer sacrifices is because Jesus offered the perfect sacrifice in the city of Jerusalem when he died on the cross. And so we no longer have to go to this physical place. That's why Jesus says an hour is coming and now is. Because Jesus has fulfilled this Old Testament requirement to offer sacrifices in a physical place. And I love how she says, we know that Messiah is coming. He who is called Christ, when he comes, he will explain all things to us. And, you know, church, Christ has come, Messiah has come, and he's the one that we look to learn how to worship God in spirit and in truth. So this is why we read the scriptures. This is why we especially focus on Jesus. The Gospel of John is so rich. And I love how it just ties into our readings in Kings and back in Deuteronomy, where we've already covered. All of it is one unified story that points us to God and his purposes and plans. So, Ashley, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you guys for joining us. We will be back again next week with another episode of the Paseo Pathway Podcast.